and get ready to turn things over for our live Q&A session for best management and technical practices for site assessment and remediation, which has been sponsored by EPA's Technology Innovation and Field Services Division, along with the Office of Underground Storage Tanks. To our primary instructor, who is Steve Diamond from EPA's Technology Innovation and Field Services Division. Steve, I'm going to pull your materials up here and let about half of your audience took and replayed the 8 hours of your training, and the other half have not. And feel free to begin, Steve, whenever you're ready.
Great. Well, thanks, Jean, and thanks, everyone, for attending today. I guess for me, the hard part is somewhat over in that I had to archive close to 8 hours worth of training materials to get this thing started. So this is really just an opportunity for folks who have both had the chance to look at the materials and even those who haven't to ask some questions, particularly the pre-submitted ones. I think we could spend some more time on. I had a chance to look at some of those and try to develop some materials. So again, I'm Steve Diamond. I'm in the Technology Innovation Field Services Division of the Superfund program, but I do a significant amount of work for other programs within EPA as well, in particular the Underground Storage Tank, the Office of Underground Storage Tanks, some of the state delegated programs, brownfields, a little bit in RCRA and others. So I spend a little bit of time in all of those different programs. Again, we're talking about a question and answer session related to the best management and technical practices for site assessment and remediation session today. So I'm going to go ahead and advance the slide here. So this is really the Q&A session for the, as Jean mentioned, the archive webinars. Here on the right you have, if I can bring up my little cursor thing, Jean.
Hold on. That happened for you?
And again, that's just the home page that we have here on the right. And I guess where this all sort of started was the development of a workshop that I delivered back in 2013 at the National Tanks Conference. I believe it was in St. Louis. And it was about a four-hour session related to what we found in the Superfund program and through some of the tech support mechanisms that I worked through to be what we think are the best management and technical practices, both for elements of site assessment and characterization, and also for remediation. And, of course, those seminars were later archived on the CLUIN platform in 2014. I've provided some links here, but, again, you can also get to each of those via the links you were sent the homepage to today's session. At the top, you'll notice those little TV screen-looking objects with the CLUIN. Those are your direct links to the archived seminars as well. Okay, so I wanted to quickly kind of just do a little bit of a topic review in terms of, and I guess this is particularly relevant for those of you who weren't able to sit through 8 hours of me talking on other topics. But again, we've developed what we think are a pretty good series of what we call BMPs or best management practices. I like to think of it as best management and best technical practices because there's really elements of both. And so the first archived four-hour session was really dedicated to best practices associated with characterization. And the reason we develop these best practices and are promoting these best practices are just through experience that we've had in the Superfund program and in the tanks programs with something we call optimization. And I spent a fair amount of time talking about optimization in the archived sessions in terms of the history of our optimization program, some of the common findings that we have, and also some of the pilots that we've been doing for underground storage tanks on tribal lands and others, and just kind of cover the gamut of where we've come through this process of optimization. For those of you who weren't able to, cover that first section, I'll just briefly, optimization is basically a systematic site review that we've been doing in the Superfund program since really the late 90s, early 2000s, where we go in and we look at either an operating remediation system, or as things have progressed, we now do optimization reviews even earlier in the process in design phases, for example, or even in the remedial investigation or feasibility type parts of the pipeline as well. So we've really been moving up this concept of optimization which is essentially an independent review by an independent team to really look at opportunities for improving site remediation, site characterization, and providing those findings to our clients, be they remedial project managers or state project managers in the tanks world, to identify opportunities for them to improve both the characterization and the remediation at site. And so some of the best management practices we talked about in that first four-hour session kind of stem from the work that we've done over the years in what we call TRIAD. So, of course, that's the elements of systematic planning, dynamic work strategies, and real-time measurement technologies. So I spent a fair amount of time talking about specific elements of comprehensive systematic planning, going beyond what we call the data quality objectives process, which does a great job at helping us focus on elements of analytical pieces of our investigation, but also gets into other uncertainties, non-technical uncertainties, and things of that nature, which we really need to identify and manage as part of our planning process. I spent a fair amount of time talking about conceptual site models, in particular with a focus on life cycle costs for things like monitoring wells and just the life cycle conceptual site model concept. I spent a fair amount of time on what I call collaborative data. Collaborative data are tools which often measure the same analyte or suite of analytes, but perhaps have different analytical quality. You could think of them as some of your screening tools, for example, versus some of your more definitive laboratory techniques. Although these days, most of our laboratory techniques we can actually bring to the field in a pretty self-contained mobile laboratory environment. I also talked about some of the high resolution tools. Those are things like direct sensing tools, like a membrane interface probe and laser-induced fluorescence, which I think people have been getting more comfortable with in the tanks universe with time, and those can provide really high-density, great information in terms of defining source areas and dissolved phase plumes associated with some of your tanks, and also some of the geophysical tools. And as well as the hydrostratigraphic tools. So geophysical tools, which can help us understand the subsurface geology and stratigraphy, and the hydrostratigraphic tools, which help us understand areas in the subsurface that we might consider as transport areas and areas we might consider as storage areas. In other words, areas of higher hydraulic conductivity versus lower hydraulic conductivity. And those contrasts, which can actually create both zones for transport of mobile phase contaminants and also storage of some of those contaminants, which it's the storage in particular and the subsequent back diffusion of some of those contaminants which can really create a difficult time for us in terms of remediation and something that we need to be aware of. It's one of the reasons why we try to push it as much as we can on the characterization side of the house. I also talked about demonstration of methods applicabilities, which are really just small sort of pilot tests and things like that that we use to make sure that we're using these high-resolution tools in a manner that's going to meet our data quality objectives and meet our data needs, will be useful given the matrix that we're facing, given the type of geology that we're drilling in. I spent a fair amount of time on monitoring wells and some of the differences between concentrations that we typically get from monitoring wells versus those that we might get from some of our more discrete vertical profiling techniques. And then finally, I spent a fair amount on things like what we consider best practices for groundwater investigation, in particular transects, vertical profiling, and the concepts of mass flux or flux-based evaluations. So that's really the first four-hour session in a nutshell. The next 3 or 4 hours I spent kind of talking about remediation, best practices for remediation. And again, it stems from our experience in the optimization program. We started out looking with optimization at Superfund pump and treat systems, where Superfund fund lead, where we were paying the bills. And we found a lot of opportunities for improving our remediation based on some of those early optimization studies that we did. We had common findings, many of which were related to poor conceptual site model, lack of data density, poor data management, all those things that we realize now many years later can really plague a project. And so there are opportunities, both in the characterization phase as well as the remediation phase, to do a better job of managing our data, developing our conceptual site models, and understanding the processes that are taking place at scales that are a little bit finer than perhaps we would have thought of in the 80s or even early 90s, for example. And so similarly for remediation, we've also identified a series of best management practices and technical practices as well. And again, it's the concept of using your conceptual site model in the design phase, the evolution, what I think of as the evolution of remedy implementation. Perhaps historically we've thought of going at some of these sites with a single large-scale presumptive remedy to more of a targeted multi-technology approach. And I think that's certainly apparent in the Superfund universe, where in the early days, in the 80s, for example, and even the early 90s, kind of the presumptive groundwater remedy for us was a pump-and-treat system. And we've actually had success with pump-and-treat systems if we were lucky enough to put those in the right places, screened at the right intervals, and pumping to remove some of that contaminant mass. But inevitably, we have many systems that were put in with good intentions that just don't operate or give us mass removal rates that are going to lead us to a restoration remedy where we can actually restore an aquifer in a reasonable time frame. So I think we're moving away from this idea of, you know, single technology is going to do everything for us and it's going to be cost effective and time effective, to this idea of more targeted approaches using multiple technologies. And of course, if you're going to do that, you really need to have an approach of a high resolution site characterization and this concept of thinking about what your completion strategy looks like, thinking about your performance metrics for your systems as early as possible, chopping your site up and treating different areas of your site differently in terms of remediation. So you might treat a source area very different or a NAPL zone very different from how you might treat the dissolved phase plume. And I think the industry as a whole has been moving in that direction. We see certainly in the Superfund program and also in the tanks universe much more of a move towards in situ technologies, in situ remediation, if nothing else, combined with perhaps a pump and treat, which I like to these days consider mostly as a good way to prevent migration of contamination. But when you're looking at dissolve phase, you're really diffusion rate limited in a lot of these sites where you're waiting for contaminants to diffuse out of low permeability units, and that's a long time frame. So we're now using kind of multiple technologies, multiple strategies that may be different for a source zone. It certainly would be different for how we might manage a plume, for example. And then, of course, in the remediation section, I got into technologies as well. Spent a fair amount of time on SVE, air sparging, in-situ chemical oxidation, excavation, some of the biological and enhanced biological processes, and even monitored natural attenuation. And I tried to stick with what I thought were mainly the types of remediation approaches that we see in the tanks universe. I did talk to some folks in Oust and found out that there is at least one thermal remedy in place in the tanks universe. So I think it's electrical resistive heating. But again, that's probably something that is going to be fairly unique to the tanks universe, and really, if you are going to do that sort of thing, has to be pretty targeted, because it can be very effective at removing mass and destroying mass and getting mass out of the ground. However, it also is fairly costly as well. So I tried to go with more of what I think are more typical types of remediation technologies used on tank sites. I also touched on green remediation, some of the considerations for sustainability, and even gave a few case studies as well as that from that remediation section. So I encourage you to look at that as well.
So Steve, before you go on, we did pull up an audience poll, and we asked our audience which remedial technologies they tried at their underground storage tanks. If you guys didn't see it in the lower left half, you should see that poll now. And the technologies were battling it out while you were talking. Thanks for those of you who voted, but it does look like excavation was the clear winner. Almost everyone has tried that. And there's a nice mix. At least half of the audience, if not three quarters of the audience, has tried every one of those other options that you listed there. So it looks like we do have a nice mix, and you hit home on a lot of the applicable technologies for
great. I mean, for me, the biggest thing on for monitored natural attenuation was just to make sure that the first word is honored in that, and that monitoring is an essential part of an M&A piece. And we like to use M&A as certainly in our bag of tricks, but typically it goes in conjunction with something else that also helps address the site. So if you are going to go down the M&A road, certainly you want to have that monitoring program dialed in. But I think, SVE, we even got a couple questions today on some of these technologies, so I think we'll plug along. But thank you for the poll. That's very helpful. Okay, so now we're going to actually jump into some of the questions that were pre-submitted. And again, feel free to add additional questions. We've allowed ourselves a few minutes at the end of each of these sections to try to address some of those questions. We did, to the extent we could, wanted pre-submitted questions so that we could spend a little more time in in-depth answering of those questions. But one of the interesting questions that came up, and I think one that I get a fair amount, is this idea of who made you boss of best management practices, right? The reality is that we've really identified these through our various technical support mechanisms that we run out of the Technology Innovation Field Services Division for the tanks programs, for RCRA, for Superfund. But they haven't been codified per se. So I guess the short answer is no, we haven't really, no one's sort of gone down the road of codifying best management practices in a more traditional way. But on the right, you kind of see that there's the sort of example or the definition that we've been using. And I should say that EPA hasn't really formally defined what a BMP is either. But the definition that we've been working with for our training sessions is something that a set of methods or techniques found to be most effective and practical means in achieving an objective while making optimum use of resources. So that's really what we're trying to do, is identify things that, for a lot of parts, people are already doing, and really trying to, make those apparent to folks and help optimize how they're doing some of these best practices. And I've even added a small little snapshot down here in the lower right of some of the BMPs that I talked about in part one. And they are comprehensive team formation, adaptive site management, project lifecycle conceptual site model, stakeholder outreach, systematic planning, dynamic work strategies, real-time measurement technologies, demonstration of methods applicability, high-resolution and collaborative data sets, 3D visualization and analysis, data management, which is pretty critical, and, of course, optimization, which is how we got here. So the second part of the question is, are they part of an EPA or state official guidance? And, again, we haven't specifically set out to do that, but I think it's fair to say that many of these best management practices are actually either explicitly mentioned in guidances or they're not explicitly excluded in guidances. And so for me, the big one that comes to mind is the idea of the conceptual site model. And I come from the Superfund universe, so we actually have a document, the Remedial Investigation Feasibility Study document, that actually spells out what a conceptual site model is. Unfortunately, we actually made an attempt to provide an example, and I'll pull that up now. And so here's the example, or something very similar to what we provide in the RIFS guidance. And we call it a pathway receptor network diagram. And it's actually very helpful. It's something that our risk assessors use all the time. But it's a fairly simplistic way of thinking about your site, where you're essentially looking at what your source was, some of the mechanisms for fate and transport, the pathways that the contamination might take, exposure routes, and ultimately whether or not we potentially have an impact to a receptor, whether or not we need to assess the validity of that impact or whether we've already determined that that impact exists. That was the example that we used in the RIFS guidance. But I think the spirit of the conceptual site model has been around much, much longer. And I've got a bunch of quotes here from various guidances. Even that RIFS guidance, says, collecting and analyzing existing data to develop a conceptual site model that can be used to assess both the nature and extent of contamination and identify potential exposure pathways. The site conceptual model synthesizes data from historical information, site characterization, and remediation system operation. So even as far back as the technical and practicability document from 1993 in Superfund, folks were talking about using the conceptual site model throughout the life cycle of the process, using the conceptual site model and historical information and characterization information well into remediation system operation. And there's many other examples of things that should be captured in. You know, one of the questions I get is what should be in a conceptual site model. There's actually a group in the Groundwater Forum within Superfund who's working on a document to try to capture some of that. But the reality is that it's really, it's all the information that you typically obtain for your sites, but I think the missing piece at a lot of sites is the interpretation. Who is going to interpret the geologic information? Who is actually going to interpret the data, the chemical information? I think that's where sometimes we fall down a little bit. And some other quotes, for instance, from the Superfund soil screening guidance. All important features relevant to characterization at a site should be included in a conceptual site model. It is an essential tool to aid management decisions associated with the site and also serves as a valuable communication tool, both internally with the site team and externally with the community. So again, even back in the early 90s, we were exploring this idea of conceptual site model being much more than just a pathway receptor network diagram. So I've come to say that not only is it the PRN or pathway receptor network too simplistic, it doesn't serve all of the functions I think that we as EPA envision for what a conceptual site model should do. It doesn't provide spatial information. It doesn't provide temporal information. Where is the contamination? What sort of geology does it reside in? How easy will we be able to remediate that contamination? So that's just one example, I think, of how a lot of these best practices that I talked about are already sort of woven into the various fabrics of our programs. And then finally, I would say that in the case of underground storage tanks and leaking underground storage tanks, you have to remember that these are delegated programs whereby the states are actually developing the regulatory frameworks to address these sites. And I can say that I've been approached recently by a number of states who are revamping various guidances or documents that they have, and many of them have come to me looking for example language to try to more clearly convey and encourage the use of many of these best management practices. And we've done some training around the country here at a number of states, and one of the prerequisites for me doing that training is I actually read their various guidances. And I would say that in almost all cases, if the best management practices that I've talked about in these sessions, in these archive sessions, are mentioned, they're either explicitly mentioned as being okay to use, or at least they're not explicitly mentioned as being forbidden to use. So many of the direct sensing tools and that sort of thing, I think, are all in play for almost all of the programs that we've looked at. I've found very few instances where I could find something in a state guidance which would have prohibited me from using a membrane interface probe or laser-induced fluorescence or a mobile laboratory or things of that nature. Now, I know that many states also have, and many programs also have, specific analytical method requirements, and that's great. That's fine. We always want to obtain those measurements, but we also want to make sure that those measurements are representative. And these other tools that I've talked about that we use with the dynamic work strategies, the high-resolution site characterization tools, the direct sensing tools, can really be used in a collaborative nature. So I've found nothing in the guidances that I've looked at that says that we wouldn't use that analytical data that is required in the guidance to, A, develop a robust conceptual site model, and I found nothing in the guidance that would preclude us from also using these direct sensing tools and collaborative information as well. So at the end of the day, these are strategies that most programs are either already using or would at least allow the exploration of the use. So what I've tried to do is bring these best management practices into programs and show practical applications. And I think once that we can show the benefit, we don't necessarily need a major guidance or policy change. Those things tend to follow once we've employed these best management practices. And I think optimization is a really good example. We haven't necessarily changed guidance in the Superfund program for optimization, but I can tell you that we've certainly changed the way we think about characterization and the way we approach remedy implementation, and certainly how we operate the Superfund program. as a result of the optimization work that we've done over the years. So we are certainly affecting thinking. Now, in Superfund, at least, it's a bit challenging us for actually for us to open guidance and reissue guidance and is one of the challenges. I know states might have, I hope states have an easier time trying to do that, so there may be opportunities for them to get some of this stuff in their guidance more explicitly. But again, I've had some conversations with a few states who have tried to provide more more implicit language about exactly what they would like to see folks using in terms of some of these best management practices.
And just a reminder, folks, if you do have a question or comment on some of the information Steve's walking through, feel free to share that with us using the Q&A window in the lower right corner of your screen. There's no need to wait. You can type it up at any time.
So another question that was submitted with regards to some of the things that we did under part one. How long ago were you doing 10 sites per year compared to the 30 you're doing now? And this relates to some of the history of the optimization slides that were in part one. And is this mostly attributed to optimization? And then finally, what is not included specifically in this optimization? So let me start by saying that our sort of history in the concept of optimization goes back to the late 1990s and certainly by the early 2000s. We were, as I mentioned, looking in the early days mostly at fund lead pump and treat systems, which we thought were operating perhaps less efficiently than they could. We started to investigate some of the reasons for the poor performance of some of the remediation systems that we had and found a whole host of issues which kind of came up time and again at a number of different sites, and they were poor conceptual site models, lack of good characterization, frankly, lack of data to even make a determination as to the functionality of some of those systems. With time, of course, that concept has changed, and I've got a little document here over on the right, which came out in 2012. So I would say right around 2011, 2012, when after, you know, almost a decade of working and sort of updating our, you know, the highest levels of OSWR in terms of our findings and efforts in optimization, it really started to trickle down back down to say, okay, we've seen the value in the optimization reviews that you folks are doing. We need to push this. We need to make it more of kind of a part of the program. And so that's really, I would say, around the 2011 and 2012 timeframe when we developed the national strategy to expand Superfund optimization practices from site assessment to site completion. That document is available online, and I would say it was right around that time frame where our group here in the Technology Innovation Field Services Division started to ramp up from doing something like tech support and optimization reviews at on the order of 10 sites per year to now more than 30 per year. I'd also say that we started to similarly expand into other programs. We've been approached by the RCRA program and how they might look at some of these concepts in the lean efforts that they're making in RCRA and how optimization might serve them. We've done some work with the tanks program. We've done some pilots with the folks in-house to think about how the concept of optimization might be worked into some of the programs that you guys administer on a daily basis. So certainly we've kind of come full circle here. In terms of the strategy itself, it's an effort by our regions, the Superfund and the EPA regions, to pursue cost-effective expenditure of dollars, lower energy use, reduce carbon footprint, improve remedy protectiveness, improve project and site decision-making, and accelerate project and site completion. So it is the best management practices that we've identified and talked about in this session, which actually addresses many of those things that we're trying to accomplish with the optimization program.
And see, we did pulse the audience here, asking them if they have ever optimized an UP site, and it looks like about a third of them have, and more than almost two-thirds have not tried, and they're not even indicating plans to do so.
Well, I can say, and this is based on my experience, but I think when you're paying the bills, that's a good opportunity to think about doing optimization, and that's when we get approached by a lot of folks. It's a lot easier to sit back and say, well, it's somebody else is writing the checks. It's not going to be a burning question for me. But we've now had, you know, we do optimization not just within our programs, but also we're doing optimization for our state partners. We're even doing optimization at sites in support of our EPA project managers for responsible party type, where they're actually paying for the cleanup. Now, we're directly supporting our remedial project manager or our tanks program manager to try to get at some of that stuff, but we've sort of woven optimization into a whole bunch of different fabrics, if you will. In terms of other programs, using or previously using or exploring or that I know of, certainly the Air Force has had an optimization program for a long time, the Navy. In fact, the Navy reported something on the order of a 6-to-1 return on investment, which we've quoted in the national strategy document there on the right. We had more difficult quantifying our numbers in EPA, but it's fair to say that it's on the order of maybe 3-to-1 in terms of return on investment. So we found that for every dollar we put into optimization, we were able to either expedite the cleanup of a site or lessen the footprint or do something to shorten the time frame or improve the performance of the system, that we're getting at least a 3-to-1 return on every dollar spent on optimization. And other elements like the Navy and the Air Force see something on the order of a 6-to-1 return on investment. So it's pretty significant. And then finally, what's not included? And this is a great question. It's really a matter of scoping. I think in the early days in particular, we kind of thought of optimization almost as like a value engineering effort, where we're really looking at the specific components of the remediation system. Can we use a different fan? Perhaps we could use a different type of piping. Maybe we could downsize a particular element of the remediation system. That's kind of the value engineering sort of piece of it. But what we found is that when we turned our teams loose to really, holistically explore the elements of a site, that's really where we got significant value. So, you know, we've done some projects where we, you know, want to look at a very specific element of a site, and we've done other projects where we sort of turn the optimization teams loose to explore all elements of the site, everything from conceptual site model to the potential completion to the need for institutional controls, even remedy and technology implementation and sequencing. And this really kind of leads us to this concept of something that we're batting around now in the Superfund program, this idea of adaptive management. How do we adaptively apply these technologies and learn from what's happening in relatively short time frames, months, and try to improve the operation of these systems rather than waiting for years and reports and turning things over to states to try to do that. We're really trying to kind of hone in on a much shorter time frame. I would say if it were up to me and in my preference, I would prefer to allow our project teams to explore all aspects of the site. And what our clients get is a series of findings and recommendations. So whether we do this in the Superfund program or whether we do this for tanks folks, what you get is a report with a series of findings and recommendations. You are under no requirement to do any of the recommendations, but at least in the Superfund program, we've now more formally expanded our tracking program, basically trying to figure out which recommendations have you implemented, and which have you not, and if so, why? And it comes down to a variety of things. It could be funding, it could be a technical problem or a stakeholder issue, but we really follow up now with sites where we've done optimization to try to make sure that folks are implementing some of the recommendations or at least have a good reason why they wouldn't. But in the, you know, on the tank side of the house, if we were to do an optimization for you, there's nothing that says you have to do any of the recommendations, but I think when you look at the reasoning behind many of the findings and the recommendations, it's pretty obvious that there are some things that you can do, some of which are low-hanging fruit, relatively low cost, to significantly improve either the performance of a remediation system or the design of a system or even the characterization of a site that hasn't had a system in place yet. So I think there's a lot of good opportunities there as well. So let's jump. Hopefully I covered that fairly comprehensively. Another question, I spent a lot of time on conceptual site models. It's kind of a subject near and dear to my heart. What's an evolving conceptual site model? Do I need special software, or does this mean I need to recreate a CSM every month? Great question. I will just sort of point to this little document here I developed a number of years ago on the concept of conceptual site models life cycle. In other words, the evolution of what that means. So I think it's fair to say that in the underground storage tank and leaking underground storage tank universe that we should all recognize the dynamic nature of our site. More importantly, we should recognize the dynamic nature of our understanding of the site. In other words, every time or any time there's data collection or a data collection effort, that can impact our understanding of the conceptual site model or the processes controlling release, migration, attenuation, cleanup, etc. So documenting our understanding of the conceptual site model as it relates to the data collection, both for characterization and to assess remediation performance, is essential. And it's done through what I like to think of as documenting the evolution of the conceptual site model. So many reports and documents I see present recently collected data, but actually few seek to draw conclusions from the data or illustrate changes of thinking or approaches or understanding of the site as it relates to the data that's been collected. And that's really what the data quality objectives process is supposed to do for us. Why are we collecting? Why do we need that information? And what did we learn from the information? And I think sometimes we fall down on the what did we learn from that information, and we default to we need more information. And in some cases, that's true. Sometimes we do have data gaps and other things we need to fill, but I'd say more often than not, it's just people not using their technical skills and using their backgrounds as geologists and chemists and engineers to really come up with, you know, some definition of what the additional data means to us. So do you, you know, I guess, do I need to recreate a conceptual site model every month? Absolutely not. That's you're collecting the data anyway, so I'm going to go ahead and forward it. And this was in that life cycle document and actually in the part one archive document as well. And this is a little kind of figure that I've added into the conceptual site model life cycle document and just focus over here on the UST side of the house. But there is a process in general that you guys all follow, right? The initial site characterization, the initial response, some sort of site investigation, development of a corrective action plan, selection of a cleanup technology, implementation of that corrective action, and there's various elements of that. There's the low-impact sites, there's risk-based programs, there's a whole variety of things. And then there's sort of the post-construction activities, right, the long-term monitoring of how is the performance of the system going. And ultimately, hopefully, we get to a point where we get to a no further action type activity, which is, you know, pretty common in the tanks universe. So you guys all follow this general process. So I just think that, you know, this is kind of an easy thing for folks to do and follow this, and you're already collecting this data. So if I were to say, when would you update your conceptual site model? It's along these different processes. After you've done your initial site investigation and your initial response, perhaps after you've collected significant data related to your corrective action or the implementation of that corrective action. So instead of thinking about, you know, do I need to redo my CSM every month, maybe it's only four or five times during the life cycle of the project, and frankly, you've already collected the data. There's already a process in place whereby you will collect that data. What you need to do is interpret the data, interpret the information, draw conclusions, and then go from there.
And Steve, we did pulse the audience and ask them how often they update their conceptual site models. And it looks like the bulk of the answers are coming in that they update as needed. Some people are indicating when they get new data or on an annual basis. Mm-hmm. And we've even had some people say we never update our conceptual site models.
Right. And again, I'd say that's really a function of data. The last part of the question was what should not be included in it, or do I need special software? You really don't need special software. I'll show you some examples of some of the work we've been doing pretty cost-effectively using 3D visualization, but at a minimum, I would think that some cross-sections should be available. I mean, I've seen a lot of reports with significant amounts of data and a single, you know, plan view map with dotted lines, a few monitoring wells, and they say, this is what our site looks like. Where we know it's much more complex in the subsurface, we know the distribution of the NAPL is much more complex, We know the distribution of the dissolve phase is much more complex. So at a minimum, I would say, you know, do yourself a favor and at least consider geology and hydrogeology as much as you consider the chemical and biological data, and include things like cross-sections and other things that give you information beyond a simple map of here's where my wells are and here's what the detections are. To me, that's not really interpretation. You need to kind of draw some conclusions from that information. And so most consultants, I think, that are out there should be able to not only provide those maps, but also do things like cross-section and actually engage in the concept of interpreting the information that they're getting from wells, the information that they're seeing in soil concentrations and other things. It seems pretty simple. Okay, so hopefully I addressed that one. Next, one of the other questions we got stemming from part one was, and I get this one a lot too, do you have examples of conceptual site models? And of course I do. This little document over here on the right is one that is pretty, there it is. It's called Innovations in Site Characterization. It's from a site that we worked on in Fort Collins, Colorado. It has a manufactured gas plant element. It also has some above ground leaking underground storage tanks and above ground storage tanks, commingled plumes. Kind of has it all. And I would encourage you to read this case study. It's fairly lengthy, but I think gives some good examples of just really simplistic cross sectional depictions of the conceptual site model as we understood it going along throughout this process. This was a great, case study in that we started in the brownfields program and ended up in Superfund removal and ultimately in the remedial program to address waste from a manufactured gas plant. But we had the complexity of, as I mentioned, near above ground storage tanks and underground storage tanks, which had leaked. One of the things that gave it away for us early on was the presence of MTBE. In the dissolve phase at the site, which we knew probably shouldn't be associated with our manufactured gas plant material. So take a look at that one. And that, I think, is a good example of some of the things you find in that case study, excuse me, are really good examples of just some simple cross-sections that you can convey a lot of information. And it shows the evolution of our understanding of the conceptual site model at that site. And that was a relatively rapid expedited process in that we went from targeted brownfields assessment to construction complete of a remedy in the Superfund program in 2 years. Actually won some awards for it. So it's kind of unique in that, in my mind, the conceptual site model was what was driving all of the decisions. We had what I call competing conceptual site models, which we came together through systematic planning and used those to define where we thought the data gaps were, address those data gaps, and actually got to a remedy in a real short time frame through several different EPA programs. So take a look at that. And, of course, there's other examples as well. And then if you want to go to the higher end, if you will, or some of the more innovative ways that we've been developing conceptual site models, I mentioned the work that the Groundwater Forum, Engineering Forum as well, are looking at here in the Superfund program to try to come out with some documents on what makes a good conceptual site model. I've got a couple things planned here coming out in the next few years, I think, that we'll kind of get at some of this as well. But I wanted to take this opportunity to show some of the stuff that we've been doing in the world of 3D visualization. So I'm going to show you a couple of quick examples. Do I need to share my screen?
Yes, we're going to change the layout here. And you can, in just a moment, we'll have screen sharing enabled for Steve. And I'll ask participants, once you see screen sharing start, so if you can see Steve Diamond's desktop, go ahead and type a message into the Q&A window and just let us know if you guys can see that.
Yes, I know it's messy. There's a lot of files on there. I apologize.
All right. And thanks. Looks like the participants are confirming your screen.
Okay. So, just to give you some perspective here, this is a software called MVS, came out of the mining visualization software. There's also EVS, which is kind of a sister to it. And this particular site is actually a Superfund site, but it's a wood treater, and it's kind of a complex mix of NAPLs, some that act as DNAPLs and others that kind of act as LNAPLs. So what we did is one of the things we typically do is we bring on right away a high-resolution aerial photography and drape it over the site. And so this is our site here. Out here, so you're looking north, essentially, and where my cursor is out in this area is basically the Puget Sound. And this is a little island just across the Puget Sound from Seattle. This is on Bainbridge Island. This is a Superfund site known as Wyckoff. And you can even see here some of the remnants of a thermal treatment pilot, a steam pilot study that was done. This white building right here is actually the water treatment plant. And there's a fair amount, a significant amount of coal tar, creosote type, as well as some LNAPL type signatures associated with the long operational history of this site. So one of the first things we do is we build the geology. So I just want to kind of take you through that. So we typically, and this is kind of a 1-to-1, and now I'm expanding it to a 3-to-1 vertical exaggeration. One of the things we like to do is kind of vertically exaggerate so that we can actually peer into our system. So this gray thing along the bottom here is our aquitard, and we're really focused on all of the waste that ends up in this area in between this lower aquitard and the ground surface. And typically we'll develop geology as a first step. So these are the 76 or so borings we had at the site, and these are all classified through the Unified Soil Classification System. And so that's really how we can develop. You can see individual locations when you zoom in. You can actually, you know, see names. And each one of these is sort of laid out into the different types of soil types. And this is a great first step. It's something we can do relatively inexpensively, particularly if your boring logs are in good electronic shape. And then we can interpret that data or start to interpret that data. And in this case, what we're doing is looking at hydraulic conductivities. The first example I clicked through was just kind of a block model of what the hydraulic conductivities might look like. And then you can do things like turning on and off certain unit types. So in this case, we're looking at our lower hydraulic conductivity units, and you see the prevalence of those down along the aquitard. But you also see right back here in the source area is a very big package of fine grain material. And then all these other areas you can think of as your sands and your gravels. So if mass is going to be stored at this site, it's going to get into these finer grain units, but it's going to be transported in these other zones, which I show here in blue. Blue, there should be the blues and greens. So here's kind of the blues and greens. So then now we're looking at a lot of our higher hydraulic conductivity zones. And this one's really interesting because on this portion of the site, we actually have a huge LNAPL signature. So most of the releases took place up in the central portion of the site. And then the ground acted almost like a chromatogram where we have DNAPL stuff going out to the west over here and down to the north along the aquitard. But then following this big channel here, we have something that has more of an more of a gasoline or lighter end type signature. And those are the lighter elements of the MGP waste or wood treater waste in this case that kind of followed out to that side of the site. So that's kind of what we start with, is developing our geology. And then we can do a variety of things like cut little fence diagrams. Again, this feature I'm circling on right here is right in the main source area and is a real fine grain unit and actually is holding a lot of our mass. And then we have these transport zones where things can get out to the east. They don't stay up very high going to the west. They actually go down along the aquitard and go out and act more as DNAPLs. And when we look at the signature of that material, it's much more DNAPL-like, whereas over here we're getting the lighter ends. And so there's a variety of things we can do to kind of depict our geology. Now I'm slicing down horizontally along the aquitard. And you can cut slices in different directions as well. So that's kind of the geologic piece. The next thing I wanted to show, I'll show two more just quick ones. And just to give you some perspective on cost, you know, this one is we've done a little more work on and it's a little more expensive, but some of the work in terms of my contracting support and costs for these sites, we did two brownfield sites in Massachusetts where we developed similar types of visualizations based on the existing data, and we did it for about $10,000 a site. So that might be something that starts to get you into the universe of what might be possible using some of these various softwares. So now what we've done, and this is all the additional work that was done leading up to the remedy that's being chosen, these are all TARGOS pushes. I talked about TARGOS in part one, but it's basically a member of the laser-induced fluorescence family. It's a 500-some-odd nanometer wavelength green laser that's very specific to the type of waste that you would find at a wood treater or an MGP. So each one of these hanging lines here is a TARGOS push, and we characterize this site. It's only about 8 acres with about 200 TARGOS pushes. And off the top of my head, I know this is probably a big number to those in the tanks universe, but when you think about the cost of the remedy, I think for the TARGOS investigation, it was less. It was about $150,000 to $200,000 to do all of this work, which really led us to where we are now with the remedy. The initial remedy for the site was a thermal remedy, was estimated to be upwards of $200 million. Our new approach, which is still being worked through, is probably going to use some combination of in-situ stabilization, chemical oxidation, targeted NAPL removal, and we're looking at something much more like $50 million. So one of the things that, yeah, we spent $200,000 or $150,000 to do all this TARGOS work, but it took what we thought was an 8-acre problem and turned it into something that was about 4.5 acres, and also told us very specifically where our hot zones are. Here we're looking at greater than 250% of the reference emitter. So these are our big, hot NAPL zones. And then, of course, we can take all of that, and I'll show just this final one, and then we'll move on. If I can figure out where it is. Help me out here. I had it earlier, and now I can't find it. Let's see.
Again, while Steve is looking for those files, if you do have questions or follow-on comments based off of some of the information he's been presenting, please feel free to use that Q&A window in the lower right corner to submit them on in. You do have about 32 minutes left in today's webinar, and we'll be more than happy to take a break in just a bit to address live questions if they come in. Otherwise, we'll continue walking through some of those pre-submitted questions after Steve is done with this live demonstration.
I thought I had one with all the historical operations. That's the one I was looking for. So what we were able to do is actually take all that information and turn it into a Creech data set. And so we're just visualizing the NAPL distribution at greater than 10% RE at the site in three dimensions. And this is not the one that I wanted to show you. So I'll take one last peek and see if I can find it, and if not, we'll move on. I don't see it anymore. Nope.
Okay.
Anyway.
We'll go back to your slide?
Yeah.
Okay.
Let's do that. So anyway, again, the brownfield sites I mentioned, we did two sites in Massachusetts for about $10,000 a piece. You know, this more elaborate data set is probably going to be, you know, a little bit more than that. But again, I mean, I think that site's a good example. If you want to scale it down to something that's more applicable to the tanks universe, you know, $200,000 worth of characterization took a $200 million remedy down to about a $50 to $75 million remedy. So a small investment cut the treatment area, and you know, by almost, you know, 75% of what we thought we needed to address with a particular technology. So that's just one example of how you might be able to use some of the newer visualization tools. How do I get this back?
You want your arrow back?
No, I need one.
Can you go forward?
No, I'm just blank. How do I get the...
I'll move on to the next slide. And if you need to just use the hard copy, we can do that.
Yeah, I guess I'll have to. Okay. Next question that was submitted from part one. Usually more data means, or more data for a site means more time and more money. How can I balance the increased emphasis on characterization with costs? I just gave you the Wyckoff example, which is kind of an extreme Superfund case, but I think you could scale that down to the types of costs that you would do for a tanks program and what that might do in terms of improving your conceptual site model to a point where your remediation footprint might actually shrink. And I know sometimes this is counterintuitive. People think, well, if I look harder, I might have a bigger footprint. But in my world, actually, the more we look, the typically the smaller the problem becomes and more manageable, particularly if we're focused on NAPL or something like that. So to address this, I would say my three words are return on investigation. So the need for higher resolution characterization increases as the aggressiveness and expense of your remediation strategy increases. So if you're using a low energy, low cost remediation strategy, you may be able to get away with doing a less rigorous characterization. But as you're contemplating doing more aggressive types of technologies, we use the term return on investigation, and we've found significant return on the dollars that we've spent for investigation as far as what it means for improvements to our remediation systems.
Here to the next slide.
So this is an example that I actually covered in part two, but this gets at the kind of the cost question as well. And this is something called the South Dakota Triad case study. It's on GLUIN. It's probably on Triad Central and other places on the web as well, but certainly you can find it on GLUIN. And this is about 10 years old now, but this was a site where legacy sites, five legacy sites, that is sites that were in the assessment phase for more than 10 years in South Dakota, were all looked at in a relatively short time frame and addressed as part of that. And so here's some, you can just forward it. Yeah, so this is what some of the, or actually go back for one sec. So these are five legacy sites, three gas stations, a closed gas station, a rail refueling station, and they were all addressed through a two-day systematic planning effort and about a two-week field effort with using mainly membrane interface probe, but there was also the installation of several wells, and each of those five locations also had something on the order of seven soil samples and two to four groundwater samples collected. But the location of those soil samples and groundwater samples was directly linked to the findings from the membrane interface probe investigation. And like I said, there's a pretty detailed case study on this. So this is just one example from one of the sites as to the type of information that you would get from a membrane interface probe on the left, and then the subsequent soil analyses that we can go back and look at those zones that the MIP identified as having contamination. We can look at actual BTEX concentrations and things of that nature. And I covered the membrane interface probe pretty well in the first part of the remediation archive sessions. The takeaway message here is the results. One-day systematic planning, actually it was about a two-day systematic planning effort, two-week field effort. At the end of this two-week field effort, they had corrective action plans for all five sites. Three of the sites had previously unknown underground storage tanks located and removed. And the other interesting thing is the density of data, 350,000 MIP data points, 25 soils, 13 groundwaters, one product sample. And then one of the sites had NFA, two of them had additional work done, and two went to monitored natural attenuation. And if you advance the slide one more time, Gene, this is the kind of final disposition. I actually met a gentleman when I was out in Sacramento doing a talk for the OUS folks at the end of last year, met a gentleman from South Dakota who gave me the final kind of disposition of all of those sites mentioned, all five of those sites that are mentioned in the case study. And let's see, the TNT standard site had a no further action in 2007. The original work was done in 2005. Severson Station, no further action in 2009. Steve Zamico, no further action in 2008. And the other two, which required some additional work, and the main driver on those two, the Husky location and the DME Railroad Station location, both had NFAs finalized in 2013, and they had Tier 3 assessments completed due to the proximity of those sites to municipal wells. That was the driving factor. But again, the work was done in 2005, and the latest site was closed 7 years later. All of these sites had been previously looked at or had been in the assessment queue for more than 10 years previously to doing this work. And then Gene's now pointing out some of the information in terms of the density of information that you get from these slides, or that you get from these, this type of technology. Trying to see it. I think it was about, the difference was about 1,400 data points for what you could consider a traditional approach of taking soil cores and screening with the PID versus some of the MIP work. So there was about 1,400 data points. If you assume every 2.5 feet taking a PID reading and collecting one soil sample for analytical analyses from each of those borings, versus what they did with this triad program and this MIP effort, 350,000 data points, which includes all of the sensors, the PID, photo ionization detector, the flame ionization detector, 20 data points per foot, so very, very dense information. And then finally, the expenditures. Several of the sites had no previous expenditures. That's the Steve Amico site and the former Husky site didn't have previously expenditures had previously been done. However, the work that was done at three of the sites bordered on about $30,000 for the MIP and the systematic planning, the installation of the or the collection of the soil and groundwater samples for the triad assessment. And each of those sites had anything from $34,000 to upwards of $104,000 worth of previous, quote, investigation work done. So when you look at the cost of what it takes to do a couple of days worth of MIP at each of these sites, again, it was a two-week field effort for all five sites. So you could think of something like 3 or 4 days per site were spent doing the MIP work, collecting the soil and groundwater analyses. So you're looking at, you know, $30,000 a site versus some sites which had already spent three times that and were still in the assessment phase in the queue for more than 10 years. And as I said, each of these sites was closed somewhere between NFA, somewhere between 2007, which is as few as 2 years after the work was done, to 2013, as much as 7 years after the work was done. So in terms of cost and time, I think that's a pretty good case study to make the case that, we can be pretty cost-effective using these types of best management practices.
Okay. It looks like we've got about 20 minutes or so left, Steve, and we are getting some questions from the live audience. So I just want to be sure we'll move through.
Okay, let's do this next one quick.
Okay.
Sorry, I lost my slide.
And this is a pre-submitted one asking about the non-technical uncertainties that you run into.
Yes, the non-technical uncertainties. There's a whole bunch of them. I would say probably the biggest ones that we face are budget, schedule, but there are many others. And so I've provided some examples of some of the stuff I use for systematic planning. And so there's just a couple of worksheets up there in the corner that I like to use. And when I do systematic planning, I actually use these worksheets. And I rather than think about what's a technical uncertainty and a non-technical uncertainty, when I go into systematic planning, I like to think of it as what data gaps or information or uncertainties do I have that require me to collect data, and what information or data gaps or information gaps do I have that require me to collect information but not necessarily collect site-specific data. So I use these worksheets. I call them uncertainty worksheets for that require sampling and those that don't require sampling. And there's a couple examples just thrown up on the slide here, and they're a little hard to see, but in terms of non-technical uncertainties, it is things like the schedule, the budget, the stakeholder, you know, if there's stakeholder issues, for example, site boundaries is another really interesting one. Let's see. I'm trying. Site boundaries, stakeholders. I don't know. There's a bunch on there. So anyway, those are some examples of, quote, non-technical uncertainties that you run into systematic planning. I want to advance the slide here. Okay. Budget, funding, schedule, stakeholder input, requirements, needs, and wants. I think that's a big one, where sometimes our stakeholders express things they'd like to have or that they need to have. It's the development of the social capital aspect of the site that's pretty important. One that I run into, access, certainly can be an issue. That can be a non-technical uncertainty that you need to resolve and try to get your access agreements. Boundaries, I've had sites where we actually went to, what is the boundary of the site? We went to systematic planning and no one knew what the site boundaries were. Reuse scenarios and action levels. Reuse scenarios play into what action levels might we need to use on a site, or might we be looking at? Is it a recreational reuse situation or a residential reuse situation? Sometimes that can affect the tools and the strategies that we might use for sampling. Whether or not we might need a well survey or existing wells in the area. If we're in tidal areas, we might think about tidal impacts or things like that. Again, information that we can get, but not necessarily information that we need to collect specifically for our site. Sometimes we can get some of this information. Other program data and actions. You know, if somebody else took a previous action, what were the tanks backfilled with? What is the extent of the cap on the site? And whether or not we have things like ICs, institutional controls, in place, or whether or not we need to explore options for those institutional controls. Those are some pretty good examples of what I would consider non-technical uncertainties, but things that can have a considerable impact on your site. And I've put a couple of these down. How I like to think of it as you can use these uncertainty worksheets in systematic planning to kind of define what the uncertainty is, what the resolution might be in terms of where we might get that information. The type of information, the quality and quantity, requirements that might be needed to achieve resolution of that uncertainty, whose responsibility it is, and the importance of those resolving those uncertainties. That's what the worksheets will do for you. And then when you move into actual remediation, you need to be thinking about this example down here in the bottom left, which is you won't have enough resources to manage all uncertainties. So which are those that have high project vulnerability, high likelihood of occurrence? Those are the ones that you want to apply significant resources to. And I have an example of actually something that we used on a Superfund site. This is Well 12A. There's a lot of documentation about this site out there. You can look it up on the web. But this is something that they actually used where they actually tried to quantify each of the uncertainties they identified through those worksheets and through systematic planning. They assigned numerical values to the relative impact if that uncertainty were to happen and the likelihood of that happening. And where you want to put most of your resources are those that would have a catastrophic effect on your project with a high to medium relative likelihood of occurring. So in the case of this site where it was a thermal treatment under a building, the question became, do we have NAPL or DNAPL under the building? And if that were to occur, that would have a catastrophic effect on our ability to actually remediate. So that is a pretty high and a relative high likelihood of that happening. That's an uncertainty that we're going to go after as a data gap and target and try to deal with. Because if that were to happen, not only would we likely, you know, fail the remediation effort, but it could really, really change our cost structure and other things. So you can use, people call these risk registers. I think if you look at the construction world and the Corps of Engineers and others, they've been talking about this for a while as something they call a risk register. This is something they use to for design. You know, what is the cost of PVC today? What will the cost of PVC be in 3 years or 5 years when we think we might develop it? They plug a lot of these things into these risk registers to decide what is the biggest, you know, the top 20% of the issues that could drive 80% of my time or cost problems. And they categorize those through these risk registers. So that might be something as well that you should that you can think about. Okay, let's jump to the part one questions, and then hopefully we can get through. There's just a few on part two as well. So.
Okay. So we did have one participant ask a question. If you, I'm going to read it. It's a little bit long. But the question asks, can you ever skip a general environmental cleanup step under special circumstances? For example, if during the pre-CERCLA screening you have a site with known groundwater contamination in a public water system well field that lies in a floodplain with karst terrain, could you skip something in order to decrease the time to achieve plume delineation and cleanup?
In terms of taking action, I think there's a fair amount of precedent in that in the Superfund program, EPA, there is, in Osborne right now, a push to take early actions. So to the extent that we can take a removal action, for example, on a site that may end up in remedial, then and that has, you know, a significant risk component to it, then we would do that. So if you're going to do what we call interim actions or early actions or things to target, you know, try to stop a release, I think there's a fair amount of precedent to be able to do those sorts of things. If you're talking about skipping elements for a more long-term remediation project, there's probably less precedent there. But I think, again, in the Superfund universe, we definitely have to follow that, you know, the NCP and the pipeline approach. But there is some flexibility as to when and how we collect information. For example, a lot of times we will collect information which maybe should have been collected in the RI, Remedial Investigation Feasibility Study. We might collect it as something, as part of something we call a preliminary design investigation, because that's where we have funding, for example. So I'd say the possibility is there to be able to skip certain elements if you're trying to take an early action to prevent a catastrophic release or some sort of impact to receptors. I think there's good precedent there. I think skipping whole elements of programs to get to a decision point earlier is a little more problematic and probably not something we'd recommend you do. But again, you can maybe move a little bit within that framework to collect information, for example, you might need later in the process in lieu of getting information that you're supposed to get at another phase. So I think the precedent is there to be able to do those targeted actions to address catastrophic releases and deal with that, you know, immediate exposures. But perhaps, you know, at the end of the day, at least in the Superfund program, we need to step through all of those hoops to get to a record of decision. The exact order in which we do some of those data collection activities, I think, allows us some leeway to do some of the things, whether we're collecting something and calling it characterization for the sake of a remedial investigation or whether we're calling it characterization for the sake of a remedy design. I think at the end of the day, we're collecting the same type of information, so I'm not as concerned about that. So I hope that answers your question.
All right, great. Thank you. So let's go ahead in the interest of time and move on with some of the pre-submitted questions for the Part 2 archive. For those attendees who are still with us, you guys can continue typing in questions and comments in that Q&A window in the lower right corner. Something else comes up.
Okay. Everyone starts a site with an optimistic goal of cleaning it up completely, and after decades of remediating, we have contaminants that just won't go away. How do you start the dialogue to revisit your site goals to get closure? Right down here in the bottom right-hand corner, I have a little note from the backlog study that Alice did, and I think that gets at some of the interesting components of how you might want to start having that, you know, starting that dialogue to revisit your site goals and whether or not you can achieve closure. I know there's a number of sites who have sort of processes, or states who have processes in place whereby they're actually trying to reduce their backlog. So I'd say talk to your colleagues. There's a number of states who are already kind of moving in this direction. So I think to a certain extent, each organization has to ask, you know, they have to be asked that in the context of their own organization. But some states have things, like I mentioned, the low-risk closures in California. Other states have varying degrees of efforts to which they'll go to remove product to the maximum extent practical. We had discussions, I remember last year in Sacramento in the workshop, where we talked about what maximum extent practical meant in different parts of the country. And so I think different organizations have different thoughts on that. But I would say all of it starts with a good conceptual site model. If you don't have a decent conceptual site model, then it's really difficult to make any confident decisions about the likelihood of success of remediation. So in the absence of that CSM, it's very difficult to say your system is performing poorly or what. I put this little picture of Mike Tyson up here in the corner because I think this is kind of the reality of us, how we work in the remediation. We always have a plan. And Mike, the great philosopher Mike Tyson said, everybody has a plan until they get punched in the mouth. And I think what he was saying is, you know, all good plans go out the window when things start to happen. And in the remediation world, you should expect that there's going to be some surprises potentially to you. And the way we're dealing within the Superfund program now is we're using what we call an adaptive management approach. So we actually expect to have some surprises or have some changes happen to us along the way, and we want to set ourselves up in both our performance metrics to be able to deal with those in a time frame that's perhaps different than what we've traditionally done. Traditionally, we've waited until we get to the end, or we have what we call a five-year review, so there might be an opportunity every 5 years to revisit our goals and closure strategy. I think now we're more looking at an annual basis where we might have an opportunity to revisit our goals and our closure strategies. So that's a little bit different. The folks in the Interstate Technology Regulatory Council DNAPL team, they use the term SMART remediation, where remediation is specific. So if, and again, this may be because some of the older sites and legacy sites didn't have this level of detail in some of our decision documents and some of our records. But I think the thinking now in terms of the state regulators and certainly within EPA is this idea of using these SMART remediation objectives, being very specific. SMART standing for specific, measurable, attainable, and relevant. So when we talk about specific, it's having like actual compound that you need to meet a specific number for. BTEX, benzene, toluene, what have you. Measurable. What are the units that we need to be measuring these things with? Micrograms per liter, microgram per kilogram, and so on. Attainable. Do we have any information that's demonstrated that the technology we're using is able to treat the contaminants that we're after to a measurable level? And I think for the most part, most of the technologies we're talking about here, yeah, the answer is yes. We have plenty of examples where ISCO and SBE and some of these other technologies have achieved, or excavation, for example, have achieved our remediation objectives. But again, the more sort of newer and innovative the technologies is, it's less and less documented the attainability of some of those things. And then relevant, as the last part of SMART. Does it reduce risk? Does it meet does it reduce risk? Does it meet certain drinking water standards? And then finally, the T in SMART, time-bound. And you need to be thinking of your performance objectives based in days, months, or years, but not centuries. And so that's really what the folks at ITRC are thinking about these SMART objectives is time-bound. We need to put something in terms of months or years into our performance objectives so that we don't find ourselves at year 10, you know, or decades, saying, well, is our system performing? We want the opportunity to assess that much more timely throughout the process in terms of months or years. So hopefully that answers the question.
Okay, we pulse our audience, and it looks like most of them are getting to closure, either at some or almost most of their sites. It was a positive answer from that one. And again, we're got about 5 minutes or so left, so we'll probably go pretty quickly through the
This was a good one. What would you say is the minimum time required to prepare reasonable performance metrics for a remediation system? Would a three-year cleanup average allow for time-dependent or time needed to make decisions based on performance metrics? The minimum time question, I guess, is kind of technology-dependent. So I would think of SVE system, for example, where I'm looking at soil vapor. I would think that the time needed to develop or to finalize performance metrics is on the order of months with an SVE system, where we feel like if you can't do a pretty good bang-up job with an SVE system in, say, 3 years or even 5 years, then something is either you've potentially chosen a technology that's not going to get you where you need to be, or your conceptual site model is very dramatically different or something. So it is technology-dependent, but I think when you get into groundwater, for example, a three-year cleanup average is probably a decent time frame. I put a document in here which Superfund just came out with. It's called Recommended Approach for Evaluating Completion of Groundwater Restoration Remedial Actions at Groundwater Monitoring Wells. And this is much at the behest of some of our project managers who basically for years were saying, I think I'm done, I think I've cleaned up, can you tell me if I can get a site completion or a site closure here, similar to what you guys would consider an NFA. And we finally developed a document that kind of walks them through that process. So I would encourage you to maybe take a look at that you can find that online. Again, it's the Recommended Approach for Evaluating Completion of Groundwater Restoration Remedial Actions. And the way that we break it up in the Superfund program, it's really monitoring for during the restoration or during the remediation, and then there's a phase for monitoring to show attainment of the standards. And I poured through the document, and I've looked through some other documents in terms of time frames. Nobody really gives a time frame, but at least in this document, they actually said a minimum for the attainment portion is 8 samples. So if you were doing quarterly, for example, quarterly measurements in a 3-year time frame, you'd at least have 8 measurements. And I think with 12 measurements. So at least with like 8 or 12 measurements, you can start to do things like trend analyses. You can start to do some statistical evaluations. So I think, 3 years is probably reasonable if you're monitoring on, say, a quarterly basis, particularly for a groundwater. So I think you're going to have longer time frames for a groundwater cleanup technology than what you might have for soil vapor extraction system, for example, where I think you should be looking at things in terms of months rather than years. When is it time to consider pulsing an SVE system? Another good question, and just so happens that this new document here I got a little link to came out in 2013. It's kind of a joint effort between the Department of Energy, EPA, and others. Soil vapor extraction system optimization, transition, and closure guidance. Certainly for me, I would say, you definitely want to consider pulsing when your system, when your mass removal rates approach an asymptotic level. That's kind of a no-brainer. And in fact, I actually spent a little time looking through this new document. It's a really nice document. It has a fair amount on not just SVE, but different contaminant types as well. But basically what there's really kind of, if you look at Appendix F of the document, there is a section in there, addendum to Appendix A. It's called Published Approaches to Assessing the Strength of Vadozone Sources. And it walks you through kind of an approach to develop estimates of how much mass remains in your vadozone. And there's two methods that they do it. One relies on Army Corps of Engineers approach from 2002, and there's a document they reference there. The other one is called the Brousseau method. And really, each of these has some similarities and some minor differences. So in the case of the Army Corps technique for estimating the strength of vadozone sources, they have some underlying assumptions of the conceptual site model, and that approach assumes that the subsurface is heterogeneous with high permeability zones and low permeability zones, probably fairly common at most of your sites. And they also assume that most of the contaminant mass resides in the low permeability zones. There is no NAPL remaining, only vapor phase sorbed and dissolved volatile organics. And the SVE system has been operated long enough to achieve a long-term asymptotic decline in mass removal rates. So if you're going to use this approach to estimate the remainder of mass in the source zone, The Army Corps approach basically assumes you're already at the asymptotic rate anyway. The other method, the Brousseau method, is a little bit different, but again has some very similar underlying assumptions to try to do it. The SVE system encompasses the entire contamination zone. Vapors are extracted during the removal of the first pore volume of gas, primary, and so the vapors extracted during the removal of the first pore volume of gas primarily represent the mass present in the permeable zones. In other words, after you've done one pore volume, you should be looking at stuff from the lower permeability units. Kind of, again, approaching an asymptotic removal rate. There's minimal contaminant mass present in the permeable zones just before the start of the rebound period, and during removal of the first pore volume, vapor removal is ideal, i.e. vapors are uniformly swept from the entire permeable domain. So take a look at this document, in particular the approach outlined in Appendix A for assessing the strength of the VADOS zone sources. And one thing they say that assessment will do is yield an estimate of the time to equilibrium during rebound periods. So that can assist you in planning pulsed operations. In other words, if I'm going to pulse the system, what am I looking for in terms of time frames for how long I want to leave the system off and how long I want to turn the system back on? You can get at those mass estimates and optimize that approach if you go through this process of assessing the strength of the VADOS zone sources. However, if you really want to assess the VADOS zone sources, you need to be approaching these asymptotic levels.
All right. Steve, it looks like we have come to the conclusion time here.
Okay.
So I think we might move on and skip over some of the questions and get to some of those wrap-up points.
Yeah, there was only one more question. So.
Oh, all right. Yeah, we do have some people who are getting ready to hop off here.
Okay, great.
So I think what we're going to do is move past some of these. Just as a reference point, we do have some additional questions that Steve did take the time to develop answers to. So if you guys are able to download copies of the presentation materials, you may certainly do so and take a look at some of those other questions that got into green remediation and bio. I think before we close out, we did want to call attention to a few elements, and that is that we are looking for underground storage tank case studies. Steve, I don't know if you can talk a little bit about some of these case studies and what they usually include.
Yeah, actually, Queenie talked to me about format. What I can say is that what we're looking for is probably on the order of 1 to 5 pages of information. I have some examples that I can share with people. I think if you go on to the green remediation part of CLUIN, there are some, there's 31 profiles for green remediation. I think if you go on the website for Triad Central and look at the Triad profiles, those are examples of the size, I think, that we're looking for. We really don't want to burden folks with trying to develop, 50 or 100 page case studies. We're really looking for something that's a page to maybe upwards of 5 pages. But the idea is to try to get, state examples of people using the best management practices that we talked about in the two sessions, using the high-resolution site characterization techniques, using some of these remediation technologies. We're looking for kind of, big-picture information, cost, a little bit on cost or performance, and how some of these best practices serve to expedite those processes for you. And so we're kind of hoping that folks might submit some of those. Case studies that we've developed in the past range from, a single page to 100 page case studies. I can tell you the days of the 100 page case study are over. We know that folks don't read those. So if we're asking you to help us develop some of these, you might be on the hook for something on the order of 1 to 5 pages. So I hope that, and if you are interested in presenting your experiences with any of these best management practices that we've talked about in these sessions, you can contact Queenie Mungin Davis, and her email is right there. She'll be our central point of contact for developing these case studies. And again, I think you can forward the slide, but the other sort of place that we might be talking about doing some of this stuff is at the next Tanks Conference and Expo. It'll be this September in Phoenix. I will be there again. I submitted an abstract. I'll be talking about high-resolution stuff. So if you have sites that are coming to fruition, sites that are coming to closure, achieving no further action, you've been using some of these best management practices or some of these remediation technologies, and you have a success story you'd like to talk about, We'd be interested in getting with you not only to maybe potentially attend and present some of your findings at the PANCS conference, but maybe help us develop some of these short informational case studies as well.
And there is also an online forum working with one of the Office of Underground Storage Tank grantees. They're actually welcoming those us and us stakeholders to participate in some of their planning teams and an online forum. So if you're interested in joining that online forum, you can certainly reach out to the grantee or actually, again, contact Queenie Munji Davis, and she'll be more than happy to work with you to get you involved with either the team or in that online forum. And Steve, any final wrap-up points you want to leave your brave audience who stayed with us here?
No, thanks for attending, and please come to the TANCS conference, and or feel free. There's my contact information if there is a question I didn't get to or a more specific question.
Moments or two, some final closeout reminders that we have, just covering through some basic questions we usually get in terms of where people can get the materials, how can I access the recording, how can I share feedback, and the new certificate tool that we'll be testing today. So I just wanted to remind everybody that we are testing a new method to receive a webinar participation certificate. In order to obtain one of these certificates, you'll need to submit feedback for today's webinar. When you follow the link to the seminar feedback form, I've already shared those with you in the Q&A window. When you're done filling out that form, at the bottom there'll be an option to validate or verify that you participated in either the entire live webinar or replayed the entire recorded version. And if you check that off, an online certificate will be immediately generated once you submit your feedback form. If you don't check that box verifying your participation or that you replayed the entire event, you will not get a certificate. Again, on the following page, it'll immediately be available to view or print, and we'll also email it to you as a PDF attachment. We are interested in hearing your thoughts about this. We get a lot of questions from people asking for documentation, and this piece of paper with a certificate seems to be one of the best ways to help you document. So we're testing out how we can deliver these to you. Again, that's just a couple of screenshots of that form, and you can click this button here to actually open it up. You'll see it as an attachment in emails, and this is what the certificate will look like. It'll verify that you participated, the session you attended, who sponsored it, when it was held, how long it was, and when we generated the certificate. And for those of you that need additional materials, we include a link to the seminar homepage right on that certificate so you can download slides and get other information. Feedback can be submitted at any point, starting now. If you're one of the lucky ones who's replaying the recorded version of today's webinar, you can still submit feedback through the online recorded version. So again, please take a moment to fill that form out. You can also email me directly and let me know what you think of that tool. If you're looking for copies of the presentation material, any of the resources and websites that Steve discussed, you'll find that on the resources or links page. Those are already listed right there in the middle right of your screen under related URLs. If you would like to reach out to Steve or Queenie, either to offer up a case study, to ask additional questions, to get involved in one of their forums or teams, you'll find their contact information listed on the seminar homepage. And then one more call, if you can, take a moment and share your thoughts about this webinar, both our new tool for certificates, but also the technique. We've never delivered a webinar like this, where we pre-recorded it and then held a live Q&A session for interaction. So we'd really love to hear your thoughts about the content as well as the method and how we deliver today's session. With that, I want to thank the nearly 80 individuals who joined us from all over the world for today's live Q&A session. I want to thank our organizers from the Office of Underground Storage Tanks. Again, Queenie Munch Davis, we couldn't have done this without you. And I want to thank Steve Diamond, who dedicated many, many hours of his time producing today's training. Again, today's session was recorded, and you will receive an automatic email as soon as that recording is available. It usually takes us about 1 to 2 weeks to produce that. And I hope that I'll either see you or hear from you on a future CLUIN Internet seminar. This will be the formal conclusion for today's live broadcast.